Good day to you. Welcome to another edition of The Front Page on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Chuck Moraz. Today joining us is Michael Hill, professor of government in the School of Public Affairs here at Morehead State University. He also serves there as assistant dean and director of the MPA and government graduate programs. He, along with James C. Klinger, an associate professor in the Department of Government Law and International Affairs and the director of the Master of Public Administration program at Murray State University, have come out with a book that's out right now. It's called Kentucky Government, Politics, and Public Policy. And Michael, thanks so much for joining us. And the one thing about this book is sort of a how-to of Kentucky government, isn't it?
It is, and thank you very much for having me here. It's a pleasure to talk about this book with you.
The one thing that I've talked with a lot of people about, Michael, is the fact that young people really don't study civics like they used to, especially, say, in the elementary schools. I know your book is not necessarily for that level, but at the same time, it's good to see a book like this to perhaps teach people about how their government works.
Well, we are often frustrated with politics and government, that it's not operating at a level that we would like it to, or perhaps even that it used to. And one of those important factors that I think a lot of public leaders have been realizing is a need for better civic education. If the citizenry doesn't understand the Constitution and understand policymaking, how can they be meaningfully involved in the governing process? So we really need to turn some attention to that. And Kentucky once had a more vibrant civic education as part of its curriculum than it has now. And I think that's something we need to be looking at.
Is that your hope for this book, that as young people come up, say, through the high school and post-secondary education systems, that they can use your book to learn more about how their government works, and hopefully maybe they'll become more involved personally with their own government?
Yes, indeed. And there's no reason that American history courses cannot make use of this book, as well as government and political science courses. But the book is primarily targeted at a college-level audience. And numerous universities, including Murray State and Morehead State, offer courses in Kentucky politics as well as state and local government. And this book is primarily intended for use by people studying in those kind of courses.
I have to admit, I got a kick out of the fact that a couple of the forewords in the book were by some very noted politicians here in Kentucky. Former Kentucky Secretary of State Trey Grayson, who had been teaching at Harvard, now has come back to the Commonwealth. Of course, U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell is the other person.
Yes, we were very pleased that they were both willing to write a foreword. Trey Grayson at the time was at Harvard University at the Institute of Politics, and he provided not only an experienced public servant's perspective, but an academic perspective. And Senator Mitch McConnell is the senior dean of our political delegation, and probably no one knows the real world of politics better than Mitch McConnell. So we were really pleased both of them could review the book and add a foreword about its context and importance.
You start out the book by dealing in depth with Kentucky's Constitution, and this obviously is probably as good a place to start as any.
Yes, always one must start with the foundations of government, and for Kentucky, that's our Constitution. Our current Constitution is our fourth Constitution. We spent most of the 19th century working through what is the best Constitution, and this Constitution has served us well. It has its drawbacks and its critics, but it has stood the test of time and has overall been a very effective Constitution, and I think Robert Ireland is one of the most eminent scholars on Kentucky's constitutional history, and we were really pleased to have him contribute that chapter to this book.
What strikes you the most about Kentucky's Constitution? I know that there are discussions at the national level. There are people I've actually heard say, and I don't agree with this, that the Constitution is outmoded. Why do we need the Constitution? It's probably just a basic outline for things, but it really doesn't need to be followed as strictly as perhaps some suggest. In your mind, when you put all those things together and maybe boil them down to a state level, do those things apply in your mind to Kentucky's Constitution?
Well, Kentucky's Constitution, like most of the state constitutions, are much more democratic foundational instruments. They're amended and modified more frequently than the national constitution, and in general are easier to do so. The people directly ratify amendments by vote in Kentucky, and we have amended our constitution many times. So rather than thinking of it as, with the federal constitution, something more set in stone long ago, The Kentucky Constitution is very much a living constitution that's been frequently amended. In fact, I think you could argue maybe too frequently amended.
Do you expect that to continue to happen?
I do. The development of constitutions in the states as we go from the east to the west, from the oldest states to the newest states, has been a trend toward more citizen participation, more democratic amendment processes. We don't have a constitutional system like California, for instance, where citizens can put questions directly on the ballot. The General Assembly can put questions on the ballot. But like most states, our citizens vote to ratify those or reject those. And we do this in a very sensible way, I think, in Kentucky. Citizens can decide on no more than two constitutional questions at a time, and the General Assembly has to be very judicious and deliberative about what it will put in front of the citizens.
When people think of the Kentucky Constitution, you know this as well as I do, the one thing that always seems to pop up now, because this has been at the forefront of discussions for a number of years, the last several, casino gaming and the need for placing the issue on the ballot so that it can become a constitutional amendment. I had a chance to talk with Senate President Robert Stivers about this very issue, and he said, that doesn't need to happen. We can vote up or down on casino gambling if we choose in the legislature, and I didn't realize that.
Yes, the legislature can do that. Depending on how they craft the legislation, it may face a constitutional challenge in the courts. But there seems to be no reason the legislature couldn't enact gambling. It's a question of, like many moral issues, when you look at Kentucky's position, for instance, on alcohol, similar to gambling, you know, it has a moral context to it. Alcohol decisions are made at the local level, not in Frankfurt, and that's by design, so that the local people can be very participatory in those decisions. I'm not suggesting that gambling would go that way, but those issues tend to be things that the legislature has for a very long time viewed as something they want the citizens to have a very direct voice in. So that's as much a political consideration as it is a constitutional one.
That was going to be my point when I talk about this. If you lay it off basically on your citizenry, then they make the decisions, and then you're off the hook the time that these citizens have to go to the ballot box.
Yes, it's very much a political issue as much as a legal or constitutional one. But in terms of the Constitution, in my opinion, there's no reason the General Assembly couldn't take action on casino gambling if it chose to.
It seems to me that when you talk about constitutional interpretations, that you see the federal Constitution challenged a great deal more than, say, the state Constitution, or am I missing something?
Well, the state constitution receives just as much challenge with regard to legislation or executive orders or regulations. The news media doesn't typically report on these, and of course, much like local government, when challenges like this happen, it's less of an interest group, national media sort of issue that tends to be challenged. Probably the most high-profile challenge that's been going on, to give you an example from the state level, has been the challenge to Governor Beshear's authority to, through executive order and executive regulation, implement Obamacare in Kentucky. There are those that have challenged whether he has the constitutional authority to make those decisions. And last time I checked, that case is still moving forward.
As you look at this and you look at the arguments on both sides, analyze this, is the governor on strong footing here, perhaps, or do these folks have an argument?
Well, I would say both. In my chapter on federalism and intergovernmental relations, I have a graphic just to try to draw the point home about the growth in regulations. They've been doubling, or more than doubling, at an exponential growth rate over the last four decades. The regulatory apparatus in Kentucky is substantial now, and much like the federal apparatus, its growth seems unabated. When you challenge the authority in the executive branch to do something like this, it raises into question, as a court must make a decision, unintended consequences across the regulatory infrastructure. So the question, can the governor issue an executive order in a particular policy area, provided he does so with the consistency with which he's done it across myriad policy areas, is going to call into question more than just simply the question at hand. And so the inertia of the system has tended to have the courts finding that Administrative Procedures Act and other legislative actions and constitutional provisions have actually supported the growth of the regulatory state. So I would expect that's more solid footing than you might imagine. because we have a federal statute and we have state statutes that do authorize the governor to act here. And that's the case his legal team has been making. But we also do have the state legislature, the General Assembly, whether or not the General Assembly will authorize expenditure to fund this is another part of the question. It will be interesting to see what the courts decide.
It's interesting because we've also heard a great deal, and this is, again, at the federal level, about questions regarding executive orders and whether it's, in essence, lawmaking, which is not the executive branch's job. It's the job of Congress, or in our case in Kentucky, the legislature's job to create laws, and the executives are not involved in that process.
Well, presidents have for a long time been moving toward more executive orders and using the executive order, especially when they don't have a very cooperative Congress. Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton both increased the use of the executive order over their predecessors. So I don't think what President Obama is presently considering isn't just following a trend that's been developing at the executive level. However, the president is overtly talking about addressing major policy issues that have been pending between the executive and legislative branches that have been acknowledged to be the legislative branch's area of authority to make the policy in conjunction with the executive. And he's talking about now going it alone. I think if he pursues the policy direction that his advisors have been hinting that he's considering, it may bring this question we're discussing to a tipping point for us to decide to what degree do we want government by executive action versus legislative deliberation.
That's more like a monarchy, isn't it?
Well, it does tend toward monarchy or autocratic modes of governing. There are aspects of the presidency that have always been like that. The power to pardon has its genesis back to that type of constitutional authority. But we should keep in mind that there's always this mixture of times when an executive needs to act in a decisive way. Certainly as commander-in-chief, the president embodies that type of authority, where sometimes decisions must be made, and they must be made quickly and decisively. So I don't think we want to curtail the power of a presidency in those regards. But we are talking here about policy issues that are historically made between the legislative and executive branches that usually begin or initiated at the legislative level. And so I think it's a real – it's a change in the character of the presidency that's at stake here.
You've also got in states and both at the federal government level too as well regulatory agencies that set regulations, and there are those that will argue that when they're doing this, essentially they're setting laws, and you've got that debate going on too.
Well, you do, but the other side of that debate, I think in their defense, is if legislatures pass more detailed and specific legislation that makes clear their intent and gives more direction to the bureaucracy will engage in less policymaking. Sometimes it's necessary to be a little bit more vague or not be that specific in order to get a piece of legislation passed. And when we look at modern legislation, it's already ridiculously cumbersome anyway. So asking for even more detail and a growth in the legislative language almost seems counterintuitive to good government. And yet that's the counterweight to what we're talking about. If we don't want bureaucrats making policy, legislatures have to do more specific legislating.
Michael, this is, again, something I'll ask your opinion on. Then is good government, in essence, when you talk about it being useful by the people that the government is supposed to serve, should it be more simplistic so that people can actually understand what's going on? Because half the time we don't know what's going on either in Frankfurt or Washington.
Well, that is the challenge that I think all free, democratic, free governing societies face. The citizenry, in order for the government to work effectively, has to take an investiture to learn the issues and be informed and understand how their government works and be participants in the policymaking process. And it is asking a lot. Our founding fathers certainly knew that. Benjamin Franklin's famous quip, when asked what sort of government did the Constitutional Convention create, he said, a republic, if you can keep it. And his implication is, of course, it's only going to be as enduring and as effective as the citizenry will make it. And that's part of our challenge. We often, as citizens, complain about government, but frankly, we don't do enough to be participants in governing to make the system better.
I want to ask you about that. We need to take a break. Again, we're talking with Michael Hale here about a book that he's written along with James C. Klinger. It's Kentucky Government, Politics, and Public Policy. And really, if you want to learn a little bit about civics and how government works, this is a great book to get into and read. You'll find out a great deal about the state and how things are supposed to work, even if they're not working in Frankfurt. And we'll go ahead and take a break on Front Page and come back with more right after this.
Mountain Edition is Morehead State Public Radio's most comprehensive local news program. Every weekday afternoon at 4:30, this half-hour magazine presents our longest news and sportscasts, features, and commentary on the news. It's a show that brings you closer to politics, education, the environment, and the arts in the part of the country where you live. That's Mountain Edition, weekday afternoons at 4:30 on Morehead State Public Radio.
Welcome back to Front Page. I'm Chuck Meraz. Our guest is Michael Hale. He, along with James C. Klinger, have written the book Kentucky Government, Politics, and Public Policy. And we were talking a moment ago, Michael, about people being more involved with their government. At this point in time, I know we're getting a little off topic, but it seems like there's a malaise out there almost, an apathy that people feel like that they can't really affect things anymore, that they really don't have a voice in their government. And maybe that's why they're not becoming more involved, because they'll say, what does it matter? What's going to happen is going to happen no matter what I do.
Well, citizens throughout history have always had that feeling. And sometimes they've had that feeling for a very good reason. They've lived under governments where they didn't have a voice or an opportunity to participate. Our system offers myriad opportunities for people to participate, from writing letters and visiting with their legislators to engaging in editorials, going to public meetings, or even running for office themselves. In addition to the responsibility we all have as citizens to stay informed on the issues and be aware of what government's doing, that accountability process is extremely important.
Your book deals with, obviously, the executive branch, the judicial branch, the legislative branch, but you also talk about local public administration, which I think is pretty important, too, because really when you hone things down, all politics are local to start with.
Yes, and that's a very good chapter for people to understand Kentucky local government with. Most Kentuckians live under the traditional system of a fiscal court with magistrates and a county judge executive, but some counties have commissions. Likewise, people that live in cities often have a mayor council, but some have a council manager plan. So cities and counties are governed differently with different structures. Some local offices are mandated by the Kentucky Constitution, but there's a variety of forms in which local government can take, and this chapter explores those forms, how they operate. And I think it's a good primer for people that want to get involved in local government, which is really where, as many people that teach state and local government say, it's where the action is. That's where individuals can get involved.
That's where they can have the most effect.
Absolutely where they can have the most effect. And it's very open. You can run for a city council race in Kentucky without having to have millions of dollars, and in some cases not even thousands of dollars. And you can still meet all your constituents. You know, it's really a great place to start for people that want to get involved and make a difference.
When we talk about the different styles of government, Michael, you mentioned magistrates versus commissioners. You talked about, say, some cities where the mayor is in charge, others really the manager is in charge, and the mayor is almost, I don't want to call him a figurehead, but he's a part-time guy or a part-time gal. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting that we can operate with these two different types of systems in both the county level and the city level.
Well, we do operate with these two different systems, and there's a lot of reasons why communities will choose one versus the other, but the dominant system is the magistrates and the fiscal court with a county judge and a city council with an elected mayor who is the head of the executive. Even in cases where in Kentucky where we have a council manager plan, most managers work very closely with the mayors, sort of as co-managers, and a lot of these reasons are driven by politics, but we would expect nothing less.
Also, something that's interesting, there are two areas in Kentucky, Louisville and Lexington, that have merged city-county governments. And people have discussed that here, even in Rowan County, from time to time, not to the point where it's ever really become serious. But that's kind of an interesting form of government where basically the county and city are one and the same in the sense.
Well, one of our chapters, a really good one, contributed by Savage, Vogel, and Elliott, looks at Louisville's merger and, as they put it, its aftermath. This is an important question. I'm glad that you asked me because I do think there's a buzz going on around Kentucky about should we have merged governments. And I think the lesson that everyone really needs to heed is that merged governments are not a panacea. They do not work unless everybody's working together to make that work. If you have conflict between city and county, if you have deep divisions in your community, if government's just not working because it's been difficult to get everyone to work together, unified government or merged government is just simply not the solution. In fact, it's likely to be a disaster that will set back a community substantially who tries to undertake this as an answer to a difficult intergovernmental governing context.
A lot of people bring it up because of the financial aspect of it. You can merge all these various services like police and fire and some other things, and you can save money there. But the one thing that a local official once told me, at the same time, though, it may remove you maybe one step away from your local government because you've got now this big broad-based government as opposed to maybe this local group that's operating now that you talk to and maybe you ask questions of and maybe you vote for or vote against.
Well, and it can change the character of local public services whenever you undertake this. A good example of that would be the police power. Some of our counties are quite large and rural, and the road systems make the response time for the county sheriffs substantially different for what it would be for a city police. And I'm talking about a difference between a couple of minutes.
So government may not be as responsive.
A couple of hours, exactly. I mean, you may save some money, but you may really curtail the quality of life and the quality of government you experience as a citizen. There are reasons we have the structures we do and the reasons they've worked pretty well. And people often don't consider that when trying to save a few pennies. It seems to me that there's no major study that I have seen. And in fact, the studies that I've done with Jeremy Hall to look at our communities where massive economic growth is occurring, a function of the number of counties or the number of governments. And we found absolutely no evidence of that. North Carolina and Texas, which have far more counties than we do in Kentucky, and where they talk a lot less about merging counties than we do in Kentucky, have experienced tremendous growth. The size of a county is, or the number of governments you have, is absolutely extraneous to whether or not you experience economic development and growth.
You also deal with, and I think this is an important chapter and one that I think people need to delve into because it's still an issue here in Kentucky, education reform.
Education reform has been a very big political issue ever since CARA was enacted. And I think education reform continues to be a political issue. Governor Beshear has worked very hard to maintain a commitment to funding Kentucky's education system and moving forward with those reforms. But it has been difficult. The economic times we've lived in have affected all the states and made continued improvements in education a real fiscal challenge for states to act upon.
You've got Common Core standards set forth by the federal government that have become extremely controversial in many places. And now you've got that impacting what would happen here at the state level, too, and whether to implement them or not.
Well, when we look at issues like the Common Core standards, of course, that's coming from the federal level. But for many years, Frankfurt had its own version of this, as did most state capitals in terms of their relations with public school systems. So the politics of curriculum and the politics of assessment has always been there. But now with these national standards and the technological developments that have happened in the interim, we have more assessment and more testing, and the achievement on that having so many consequences to the fiscal viability of school systems that people are working from the assessment mechanism rather than from the learning mechanism. And students and teachers alike, who are quite open and honest about it, will vent about how they've experienced the system changing for the worse under these kinds of policy directives. We must find some kind of balance because the attempt to assess and compare quality and what's working is very good direction for education policy to go in. But it seems like there's a lot of problems with how we've gone about doing that.
Michael, thanks for joining us today. It's been fascinating to have you on the program and talk about the book. It's a good read if you want to learn about what's going on at the governmental level here in Kentucky and also about politics and education and other things in general.
Well, thank you very much. I do hope people get a chance to take a look at this. It's meant to help people understand Kentucky government and politics at a much deeper level. While we don't have a lot of opportunities in core requirements, there are some great elective courses like state and local government and Kentucky government that people that want to learn more should sign up for and get involved with.
Again, that's MSU Professor of Government, Mr. Michael Hale. Also, he wrote this book, by the way, with James C. Klinger, who works at Murray State. It's called Kentucky Government, Politics, and Public Policy. I'm Chuck Meraz, host of Front Page. See you next time.